vaccine mandates, and our society. Maine has mandated that all healthcare workers be vaccinated against COVID-19. President Biden has issued a sweeping federal vaccine requirement for as many as 100 million Americans. Many private companies, including major airlines, drugstores, newspapers, and fast food chains, have instituted vaccine mandates for their employees. But unions and other organizations are pushing back, and in some cases, filing suit. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we talk with experts about the legal and ethical questions raised by vaccine requirements and how different sectors of our state and country are responding to them. And we'll hear from Maine author Christina Baker Klein, who attributes her father's death to an unvaccinated healthcare worker. Conflicts over vaccine mandates next. But first, this news. Welcome to Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. The pandemic has accentuated the divisions in our society, and the latest battleground? Vaccine mandates. Today, we're going to talk about the legal and ethical issues surrounding vaccine requirements. Joining me, Jessica Miller, who is a healthcare ethics consultant and associate provost for academic affairs and faculty development at the University of Maine. Also with us, Dimitri Baum, who is vice dean, provost, and professor of law at the University of Maine School of Law. We invite your questions and comments. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment to Twitter, Facebook, or Instagram, or give us a call, 1-800-399-3566. Dimitri, we'll start with you. Give us some legal background on the whole concept of vaccine mandates in this country, and has this issue actually made it all the way to the Supreme Court in the past?
Well, it has, but a very long time ago. You know, this is an area of law that, you know, nobody really teaches in law school. We hadn't taught in law schools until 18 months ago. Now, seemingly everything is focused around pandemic law. But the classic case here that reached the Supreme Court is actually from Massachusetts. 1905 case, Massachusetts versus Jacobson, where Massachusetts required, mandated a smallpox vaccine. And there was this legal question of whether or not that violates somebody's individual liberties, not to be forced to vaccinate. And the court decided that case and said, yes, the state does have the power, the authority to mandate vaccinations.
And let me ask you, Jessica, are there certain, ethically, when you're thinking about this on an ethics level, are there certain basic criteria for when a vaccine mandate is justifiable?
Yes, we look at things like overall benefit. For example, public health is a good that we value, and we've agreed as a society that we want to protect it with things like the CDC and the FDA. So we look at the overall benefit. We look at things like the harm principle, the idea that one of our moral obligations to one another is to minimize harm. And we also have to look at our bodily integrity and personal liberties and freedoms when we consider this as well.
Is this, Jessica, a close one? Is this one that's a difficult call?
Well, I think it depends on who you ask, but I will say that the vast preponderance of bioethicists in the US and philosophers who study this do think that the deck is really stacked in favor of a vaccine mandate under the current conditions. I mean, it's a public health emergency. 700,000 Americans have died, not to mention disabling complications and psychosocial havoc. We have a safe and effective way to minimize transmission and end the pandemic. So I think when you look at the context, it's something that I think most of my colleagues would agree is not a tough call.
All right. Well, joining us now is Jean Lambrew, who is Commissioner of Maine's Department of Health and Human Services. Thanks for calling in, Commissioner.
Good morning.
Could you lay out for us, describe exactly what is Maine's requirement for healthcare workers to be vaccinated right now on this date, October 26th?
Sure. So starting in June, the Maine Hospital Association and other partners in the healthcare system called on the state to add the COVID-19 vaccine to the set of vaccinations that are required of all healthcare workers. This is because the data in Maine show how critical it is. As of yesterday, 6,795 healthcare workers tested positive for COVID-19. We've had over 350 outbreaks associated with health and long-term care settings. So we announced this policy in August. We gave facilities 2 months to implement it. And shortly after we announced the policy here in Maine, the federal government announced that it soon will make COVID-19 vaccination a requirement for healthcare workers nationwide.
And Commissioner Lambre, what do you say to those who are pushing back against this and say that there ought to be some sort of alternative, maybe if that alternative is, say, testing twice a week?
So all the evidence points to the fact that, number one, vaccine is our way out of this pandemic. No amount of testing is going to keep somebody safe from some of the severe effects of COVID-19 should people get it. And this Delta variant has proven how resilient and tricky the COVID-19 vaccine can be. So it is certainly the best tool in the toolkit to fight COVID-19. And let's just go back to healthcare settings. It's where our most vulnerable people go when they need long-term care, when they need healthcare, surgery, some sort of procedure. They go to healthcare settings, which puts them at greater risk of severe complications from this virus. So I think we're not alone here in Maine in looking at the evidence and seeing that for this set of workers, these healthcare workers who have done an amazing job in the past 19 months, the best way to protect them, their coworkers, and the people they care for is vaccination.
Commissioner Lambre, as the deadline is upon us, I'm wondering about your concerns. We're hearing about certain hospitals suspending certain kinds of procedures. We know that there are concerns about staffing in group homes and nursing facilities. What are your biggest concerns going into the month of November with this vaccine mandate actually meeting up against its hard deadline?
You know, I think when you look at the numbers, you have to look beyond the number of workers who may choose to leave their profession instead of getting a vaccine, to look at the number of our healthcare workers who've been sidelined because of it. Again, there are thousands of these workers who've gotten COVID-19. There's thousands more that have had to be out on quarantine because they're exposed to somebody with COVID-19, which again, by definition, many of these people are caring for people with COVID-19, so they're at greater risk. All that said, we've had this long-standing healthcare workforce shortage here in Maine. We're an older population, which means people are on the verge of retirement as well as needing more healthcare. So we have an all-of-the-above strategy to try to help. That includes, in the long term, Governor Mills announced yesterday plans to do loan repayment, on-the-job training, and attract people into our healthcare jobs. She announced $14 million from the Maine Jobs and Recovery Plan for that. We also have, in the short term, been working on providing our facilities with resources. Just this fall, we provided $143 million to our hospitals and nursing facilities for recruitment and retention. We also looked at flexibilities about how we bring people into jobs. We looked at recruiting resources. How do we give them the connections to the different pockets of people looking for jobs in the state? And we've also looked on retention, because a lot of the problems we're seeing right now are due to the, again, 19 months of very challenging work during this pandemic. So this fatigue and the stress of these jobs is high. We have a program called Strengthen Me, which is aimed at giving our healthcare workers some of that support they need to get through this pandemic.
Well, Commissioner Lambre, thank you so much for calling into Maine Calling today. Commissioner Jean Lambre, the Commissioner of the Department of Health and Human Services here in Maine. And I wanted to ask you, both Dimitri and Jessica, are there different legal or ethical standards for healthcare workers being required to be vaccinated as opposed to workers in other fields? And Jessica, I'll start with you.
Yes. In July, a joint statement was signed by more than 50 healthcare professional societies and organizations that called for healthcare employers to require vaccination against COVID-19. I've already mentioned the harm principle, which applies to everyone, to do what we can to avoid the harm of COVID for our friends and neighbors and coworkers. But professional duties grounded in beneficence, doing good for others, and non-maleficence, avoiding harm to others, are even higher if you are a healthcare personnel. So hospitals and healthcare facilities, as the commissioner mentioned, are settings where disease transmission is more likely to occur and the consequences are more likely to be very severe because of the high number of sick and immune compromised people there. And we can go back to the codes of medical ethics, the Hippocratic Oath, you know, do no harm, also for nursing and other allied professionals. I heard a surgeon say to me, you know, there was a time when if you have had a major artery wounded, an amputation was the right thing to do. Today, trauma surgeons can often save that limb. And it's equivalent, you know, to have a healthcare personnel say that they're not going to get vaccinated. I've heard a surgeon say to me, it's kind of like having someone say, well, no, I'd rather amputate this limb. I know how to treat this patient, but I'm just not going to do it. I don't think that's a perfect analogy at all, but it does kind of get at some of the frustration that I've heard expressed by some healthcare providers.
Dimitri.
Yeah, I mean, legally, there isn't necessarily a different standard that applies in healthcare. So there's the constitutional rules that apply to any government regulation, any law passed by the state or federal government. And there's statutes, employment statutes, the Title VII, OSHA rules. Obviously, the actual application of the rules may be different depending on context. So the government's rationale or justification may be stronger or weaker depending on which industry we're talking about. But the legal principle, the legal tests are the same regardless of the industry we're talking about.
How about, Dimitri, legal application in terms of government workers versus private sector workers?
Yeah, so there's a little bit more leeway. And again, it depends on which level of government we're talking about as well. So, you know, a big part of the conversation has been who can pass these kinds of mandates, right? Federal versus state. So the federal government has much more authority, much more power to regulate its own employees, its own contractors, and then federal spaces, right? In interstate travel. So that's where we saw kind of the initial wave of the mandates. Private regulation has been a little bit harder for the government to implement. So you've seen the move by the president to use OSHA and impose some guidance on major companies and big corporations to try to get at those private companies. In terms of, you know, private entities regulating, there's no constitutional standards there. The Constitution doesn't regulate what a private company does. And there then the question becomes, does it violate some kind of a statute not to include an exemption for disability or for religious accommodations?
All right. Well, so much more to talk about on this, but I want to turn to a special caller now. We have Christina Baker Klein. Christina Baker Klein, I'm sure you've heard her name, best-selling author of 8 novels, and recently wrote about how her father died of COVID-19 after being exposed to the virus in the hospital. I believe, Christina, you first wrote about this in the Washington Post. I remember seeing this there. I know your father passed away earlier this year, and I'm so sorry. Tell us the story.
Hi, Cindy. Thanks so much for having me on. Yeah, it was sort of a slow motion train wreck that all had to do, unfortunately, one way or another with COVID. My dad was 83. He broke his hip in June. He was then in rehab in quarantine for 3 weeks, but that didn't matter. He was doing physical therapy, but the operation had been botched. They'd put pins in that slipped. So he needed a second operation, but because where he lived, Aiken, South Carolina, they suddenly imposed, there was a statewide mandate that there were no, because of unvaccinated COVID people in the hospital, there were no what they called non-essential surgeries. So we were boxed out. He came to Maine to spend the summer with us, even though he couldn't walk or even stand. But it was lovely, and he was in great spirits and health and everything else. And we were so excited. We got a great doctor at Eastern Maine to do the surgery. The doctor said, your father is doing great. It's fairly routine. Of course, any surgery over the age of 80, you know, they don't call routine, but he said he will be in rehab in 1 to 2 days, 24 to 48 hours, which is the way it's always supposed to be. So he came through the surgery with flying colors. He was actually standing and walking, laughing, fully, you know, great. Everything was set. He was cleared to go to rehab, and there were no beds because of a surge in unvaccinated people taking all the beds. And this was all through Northern Maine. We couldn't find anything within 3 hours or more. There was just literally nothing. So he stayed in the hospital for weeks and eventually contracted MRSA, which is a deadly hospital-borne illness, which happens when people stay in the hospital for a long time, particularly older people. And it just, again, all went downhill from there. And the final straw was that his unvaccinated nurse got COVID. We learned this a week before he died. And 4 days later, he was diagnosed with COVID. He was quarantined yet again. And throughout this entire experience, there was lots of quarantine for this poor man who was just wanted to be with his family. And anyway, he died. He didn't die of COVID. He died of this series of infections. But what I was so upset about, what I wrote about for the Washington Post, was that at every step, he was thwarted essentially by the fact that there were so many unvaccinated people needing medical care, and then eventually his own nurse. So that was just something I couldn't let stand without comment.
Yeah, and I have a feeling I know the answer to this question, but given the topic of today's program, I have to ask you, Christina, how do you feel regarding the vaccine mandate now in place for healthcare workers?
Look, my philosophy is this. To spread the coronavirus, you have to have the coronavirus. And unvaccinated people are far more likely to have the virus. According to the CDC, more than 96% of COVID cases are among the unvaccinated. The unvaccinated are responsible for the overwhelming majority of transmission. So it seems utterly clear to me that we need to vaccinate people and that there should be a mandate for healthcare workers with no question. I mean, people get measles vaccinations. People, you know, get, without even thinking about it, there are all kinds of rules and regulations about vaccinations. And the fact that this one has become so politicized, when every bit of evidence is that it's safe, it's effective, and it saves lives, is kind of bewildering to me. It says something about the times we live in that, you know, people are willing to risk not only their own lives, but the lives of other people for this issue.
Christina Baker Klein, I'm so sorry for your loss, and I so appreciate you sharing your experience with us today. Christina Baker Klein is an author, and she's here based in Maine. We're going to take a quick break. When we come back, more of your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from the Lunder Foundation, founding partner of Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical, and by Options, a program of the Maine Office of Behavioral Health, connecting Mainers to treatment, recovery, and harm reduction resources. Details at knowyouroptions.me.
With ransomware attacks on the rise, the Biden administration is looking for ways to protect the nation's infrastructure. Skeptics doubt much can be done to stop private and state-sponsored hackers, given the interconnectedness of our society. Solutions being considered range from lifting the veil on cryptocurrencies to making it against the law to pay ransom to cyber criminals. But would that work? Banning ransom payments to the hackers. That's next time on Intelligence Squared U.S.
And you can hear that broadcast this afternoon at 2 p.m. here on Maine Public Radio.
This newfangled hybrid work model a lot of offices are adopting, who do you suppose is going to be in charge of it?
There's the part that's so exciting, and you're thinking of completely new ways of working and these big dreams.
I'm Kai Rizdahl, supervising a 9-to-5 workforce that is not in the office. Next time on Marketplace.
Join us for Marketplace today at 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
And welcome back. This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, vaccine mandates, legal and ethical issues, and why they're being debated in Maine and nationwide. My guest, Dimitri Baum with the University of Maine School of Law. He is a vice dean, provost, and professor of law. And Jessica Miller, a healthcare ethics consultant and UMaine professor of philosophy. Share your comments or questions. Email talk@mainepublic.org. Post a comment to Twitter, Facebook or Instagram, or give us a call at 1-800-399-3566. 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to Sam calling from Standish. Hi, Sam. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. I'm concerned that just firing nurses who don't, or other staff who don't get a vaccine isn't enough. It really needs to be a licensing requirement, because if you're going to be in the health profession, you have to care about the people that you work with, you serve. You can't be infecting random people around your hospital or healthcare environment. And we require people in other occupations to get hepatitis and tuberculosis and other testing. This is appropriate. So they need to have this as a licensure requirement, and also bring back the LPN and nurse training programs at hospitals so that we have a better supply. Thank you.
All right. And Sam, I know that your feelings about this are shared by many. It's Jessica or Dimitri, anything to add to what Sam has said?
No, I mean, it's obviously the industries have lots of leeway to impose licensing requirements that make sense. It's really more of a kind of political question rather than a legal one, trying to decide what are the essential characteristics of the position, of the job, and what should be required for the position.
All right, Sam, thanks for your call. I'm going to move on here to Friedrichs calling from Milo. Hi, Friedrichs. Go ahead.
Hi. Hey, you know, simple fix would be to just make people who refuse to be vaccinated cover their own costs when they end up at the hospital ICU unit, which, by the way, if they are insured, it's going to run up costs on my premiums from the insurance pool that I play in.
Friedrichs, you know, I've heard other people say that as well. Jessica, and from a healthcare ethics perspective, you know, I've heard people say, look, why should I have to pay for somebody who has not been vaccinated? Why should I have to pay for them to be treated for COVID with my healthcare health insurance premiums? What is the ethical conversation that goes on say this?
Yeah. Well, I'll start by saying that we know that vaccine mandates work. Okay, so we can look at some major corporations like Tyson Foods. When it announced its requirement, only 45% of its workforce had had the shot, and it went up to 72%. Delta Airlines did something interesting. They said now they have 90% of their 80,000 employees vaccinated. But what they said is, look, if you don't get your vaccine by November 1st, you're going to owe us $200 more a month for your healthcare plan. So I'm all for changing incentives in bioethics literature. We call them nudges sometimes, just kind of doing what we can to encourage. I am concerned, though, from an ethics point of view, of singling out groups of patients and, giving them what could potentially be below the standard of care. We don't know for sure in every patient's case why it is that they are unvaccinated. They could be one of those very, very, very few people who actually have an allergy, which is very rare, but it does exist, to an ingredient in the vaccine. They could have been misinformed. Maybe they had lack of access to good information. So there are lots of reasons that I think in the heat of, care in the moment, I would be very reluctant to support sort of singling out those patients at that point. But what Delta Airlines is doing sort of at the beginning, when healthy workers are making the choice, I think that's a fairer way to go about it.
All right. And what about, Jessica, people who were saying, I'm going to wait until my company offers some sort of bonus? I heard about people saying that.
Well, like I said, we do know that, there are lots of ways. I didn't mean to sound glib at the top of the show when I said I didn't think it was a huge ethical dilemma about the mandate. I want to be clear that any time that we restrict people's liberty, even in small ways, it's a big deal, right? We are founded on our liberty rights, and it's very important. But I do think that there are lots of ways that we can encourage, and that incentive is one way. People to feel like it's their free choice, to feel not coerced. On the other hand, how coercive is a mandate when somebody could, in fact, seek another form of employment? So it's not like we're saying we're going to put you in prison if you don't get a vaccine. So I think we need to bring all the tools to bear, including education, all the good public health tools that we need to help people make the right choice for themselves and their community.
All right. Thank you, Friedrich. So I'm going to move on to Jessica, who's calling from Portland. Hi, Jessica. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to share my personal experience. I tend to be allergic to many medicines. I was nervous about getting the shot. I passed with flying colors. However, my husband did have a pretty severe 14-day reaction that later was discovered he probably was exposed to COVID when he got the shot due to the symptoms. But his second shot, we waited a few months, and he did fine. He was super healthy. I do believe a lot of people are scared of the unknown, and that's why they're holding back. So I just wanted to share that experience and perhaps just make sure you haven't been exposed to COVID before you get a shot.
All right, Jessica, thank you so much for calling and sharing your perspective. I do appreciate that. We're going to move on now and talk to Senator Jeff Timberlake, a Senate Republican leader who is from Turner. Senator Timberlake, welcome back to Maine Calling. I realize, I know that you have spoken in favor of alternatives to vaccine mandates. We touched very briefly with Commissioner Lambrew at the beginning of the program about this. Tell us why you think mandates are not necessary.
Well, it's because of what's happening to the healthcare system. Let's be honest. I'm vaccinated. I've had the booster. I've encouraged everybody in my family to get vaccinated. So I'm not an anti-vaxxer. Okay, but I'm more concerned about the constituents in my area and where I am. And when Central Maine Medical Center or Central Maine Health Center called me about 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks ago. They called me up and said, with Senator Claxton, myself, Representative Dillingham, and said, we have a problem. And the mandate has now made the problem a lot bigger. So we need to do something. Can you ask the governor if they could please not remove the mandate, but take the mandate back so that it would allow testing for those who don't want to get vaccinated? And we didn't say that whether it had to be once a week, twice a week, every day. We wanted to have a discussion about how this would happen and how it could keep the people in my district safe. And this is about healthcare. And their big concern was that not only was the people who quit because they refused to get vaccinated a problem, but it was the pressure it was putting on those that were working there. And there's a lot of concern that an awful lot of people in the healthcare field, which we've called heroes for the last year and a half, and they are heroes, every single one of them, from the people who quit, wash the floors in the hospital to everybody up through, that once they did this and put this in place, it was putting pressure on. I had two people up to my farm this weekend who are still in the profession, and they said, I don't know how much longer we're going to stay because I can't take this pressure. And so what CMMC was really concerned about, the second wave, and the second wave being that people are close, that people that were close to retirement or just could go find something else would get out. And it's going to degrade our healthcare system. I don't care if I go into hospital with a heart attack, if the person that works on me has been vaccinated or not. I want them to take care of me, my daughter, my wife, my grandkids, whoever it is. I'm not going to question where they're at. We don't question today, and that's what I feel. And I'm looking for a solution to a problem that the healthcare industry has come to me with. I didn't go to them.
Senator Timberlake, let me ask you about this, though. Earlier in the program, we heard from Christina Baker Klein, whose father was in the hospital for a hip replacement and later died. After being exposed to a nurse who had COVID who was unvaccinated, I know of other people who were exposed to healthcare workers who were not vaccinated and contracted COVID. But you say if you go in with a heart attack, you don't care if your healthcare worker was vaccinated or not.
I'm sorry. It really doesn't bother you if somebody is not vaccinated and is treating you in a healthcare setting.
No. I work in the public every day of the week, whether it be in the hardware store or whether we go out to supper or whether we go and I'm around people. I know 7 people in my community right now that have COVID, and all 7 have been vaccinated. So the fact of the matter is that the vaccination doesn't stop you from getting it, doesn't stop you from spreading it. So you could be a healthcare worker that's been vaccinated. No, you might not get as sick, but you can still spread it and you can still get it. So it's not a cure-all. I think we have PPE, personal protection equipment, that protects the people. When I go in, they're all going to be wearing masks, face shields, Tyvek clothing, all the things they're supposed to wear to protect themselves that they've been wearing for the last year and a half. And I don't think that the chances of me getting it are very small. Now, there's chances we take in life and everything we do, but I don't think that's the only chance that I'm going to worry about today. I'd lots rather make sure that if I was having a heart attack, or my wife or my mom or anybody that I know or love, you know, gets the care that they need to save their life. And the problem is, we're not saving lives when we're running hospitals at 30% or 50% of their capacity. And the only reason we're there is because they don't have enough nurses and healthcare workers to man the beds.
I see your perspective. And let me tell you, our guests today are with us, Jessica and Dimitri are, one is a medical ethicist, one is a law school professor. And I'm wondering if you see this as an ethics issue, if you see this as a legal issue, or how you view this, or if you see this basically as a very pragmatic issue.
Well, I'm a fanboy, and I look for a solution to the problem. The industry came to me and said, this is what we asked for. This is Central Maine Medical Health Center came to us and asked us for this. So I figure they're experts. They had doctors on the call. They had all of their people on the call. That's what I figure. They know what they're talking about. I trusted them with my life when I've been in for a couple of heart attacks in my life. And I trust them today with the information they give me. Our people have been working for the last year and a half. They've been doing a very good job. Yeah, there was probably some accidents, but I can also tell you some people that went in for operations that had accidents that didn't come out well, and it wasn't because of COVID. So things happen. It's in God's hands in a lot of cases, but, you know, we need to do what protects the health industry. So I look at this as not an ethics issue or a political issue. Everybody thinks that this is political to me. It's not. This is about protecting the people in my district. This is what they've asked me to go do, is represent them. And I've asked to have a conversation. All I ask is that we can sit down as legislators and have this conversation. And we haven't had that. And I don't know if that's the right way to handle it. You know, I may agree with them in the end that maybe it's not. But that's what they have asked for. So I think we should at least grant them that conversation.
All right, Senator Timberlake, well, you're still on the line. Jessica Miller, I was wondering if you have any thoughts on what Senator Timberlake has said here today.
Well, I really appreciate Senator Timberlake's perspective. I think, you know, ethical issues aren't issues where you have one really bad person that we have to shame and blame. They're issues where basically good people disagree about how to move forward with a problem. And maybe they have different values, or maybe they have the same values, but they kind of rank order them or prioritize them a little bit differently. And so the problem that the senator is raising is a real problem. You know, I don't know how widespread it is. I think there may be more concern about it than actually a problem, but it depends on the hospital. It depends on, you know, where you are in the state. So I think we don't want to dismiss it. This is an issue. If you're a hospital administrator, you have to figure out how to get patients cared for and staff up. I will say that this is coming on the heels of shortages in different areas, like nursing, for example, where we have an aging workforce and increased demand, especially with an aging population. So we were already kind of in a situation with potential shortages in different sectors of the healthcare profession. And this kind of, you know, has hurt some hospitals even more. But I think this is a problem that we need to sit down and talk about and say, okay, what's the best way to manage this? But in the end, above all of this is minimizing the number of cases of COVID. And the best way to do that is to get everybody vaccinated.
And can I just jump in here? I agree with every single thing she said, that I don't think either one of us wish bad on anybody. We may agree to disagree. Some of us may agree to disagree on how we get there, but I think we should have the conversation. But the thing that I don't know is if we discussed in this, which has really exacerbated this problem, is our nursing home and those facilities and our home health care workers that are closing and forcing people to stay longer in the hospitals and shutting down more problems. So this problem is not just with hospitals. It's with our nursing home system, our home health care people. This problem is growing, and those rates of vaccination are lower than they are in the hospitals. And so this is how I look at it. I'm just looking to have a conversation, and that's why we sent the letter out. You know, I'm not looking to make it political. I want an answer to a problem, and I want to help the people of the state of Maine.
Well, Senator Timberlake, I so appreciate you calling in today and joining the discussion on Maine Calling. We do need to take another quick break. More audience calls and questions when we come back.
Listener support brings us Maine Calling with help from Ocean View at Falmouth, with a goal of promoting optimal health through active retirement living. OceanViewRC.com. By Champlain College Online, offering certificates in business, healthcare, and IT. Champlain.edu/New England. And by Real Maine, a program of the Maine Bureau of Agriculture, featuring in-season and easy-to-access agricultural products. Visit RealMaine.com.
I'm Scott Tong. China has put out its 14th five-year plan. Turns out it's kind of a roadmap for the technologies they're trying to acquire, in some cases through corporate espionage.
Within the next 5 years, they're going to go after these technologies, and you're a key player in this space. You need to be thinking about how you're going to defend against that.
That's next time on Here and Now.
Stay with us. Here and Now, upcoming shortly at 12 noon today here on Maine Public Radio. Have you subscribed to The 10? The 10 is Maine Public's weekly e-newsletter that takes a closer look at 10 exceptional, thought-provoking, and compelling stories. These are stories not necessarily from the week's headlines. In fact, most are stories that you may have missed from Maine Public, NPR, PBS, the BBC, and more. To sign up or to check out past issues of The 10, please visit mainepublic.org.
And welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. We are discussing the controversial issues surrounding vaccine mandates. Joining me, Jessica Miller, medical ethicist at UMaine, and Dimitri Baum, law professor at UMaine as well. Join our conversation, 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org. You can tweet at Maine Calling or post to Facebook or to Instagram. One thing we have not touched on yet, Dimitri, is the role of religion in this discussion. Is this an area of law and an area of personal liberty in which religion has a valid stake in the discussion? Are there religions for which vaccination is something that is not allowed, or there is a valid argument against becoming vaccinated?
Well, it's an area of law that's been certainly fast developing. The court has been expanding its First Amendment jurisprudence, free exercise jurisprudence. You know, since 1990, the court had said that generally applicable laws, laws that don't target religion, intentionally discriminate against religion, they're only subject to the kind of lowest level of scrutiny, and they're generally upheld. In recent years, the court has been a little more vigilant about protecting religious freedoms and religious liberties. And so I guess there's a question about whether or not a state which carves out some other exceptions to vaccine mandates also has to have one for religious reasons. But generally speaking, under the First Amendment doctrine and under this Employment Division versus Smith case that I mentioned from the early 1990s, a generally applicable law does not have to have a religious exemption. And courts are very hesitant to inquire into somebody's religious belief. So even if there is no official religion that prohibits COVID vaccinations, courts don't tend to ask that question as long as somebody has a sincere belief that their religion prohibits them from the vaccine.
All right, we're going to go to, let's see here, Michael calling from Bath. Hi, Michael, go ahead.
Hey, Jennifer, thanks for taking my call. Great conversation. Thank you for the experts on the panel. Just calling in response, I was really fired up about that state senator who seemed to put the medieval technology of PPE on parity and on par with the vaccine. It's just absolutely not a stand-in. It's not okay to talk about that. Like, you know, as long as my healthcare workers are wearing their PPE and their masks and, you know, their PAPRs and all the exhausting things that we've been putting up with for the last year and a half, we just need a full-throated, everyone get the vaccine, let's get out of the pandemic, stop overcomplicating it, stop talking out of both sides of your mouth, stop making it political, and telling us it's not. Thanks very much.
Thank you, Michael. Jessica, thoughts?
I will say that in the early stages of the pandemic, a lot of healthcare providers had legitimate concerns about inadequate PPE. And I do think that there's a moral obligation on the part of employers, especially where you're actually tending to and treating people with this infectious disease, you know, to provide the right protections. This was pre-availability of vaccines. But I do, and I also think we need to continue to look at this as a multi-pronged approach. You know, here at the University of Maine, we are still masking indoors, for example. And, so I think continuing social distancing, masking, monitoring yourself for symptoms, we all need to continue to do all of that. And PPE are a part of that for the right type of employee. But I agree with the caller that really the vaccination is really the thing that is going to minimize the cases and the spread. That is our number one weapon right now. We know that, you know, some things are in development that could potentially, if caught early, minimize the symptoms, minimize deaths from the disease once acquired, but that's still, you know, not with us, maybe early next year. So right now, vaccines are our best weapon against this pandemic.
Michael, thanks for your question. An email, speaking of the University of Maine, an email from Dan at UMaine. The University of Maine system reports that their fall student population is about 93% vaccinated with about 7% exempt, and they are online only. The 208 students who are non-compliant with the university's vaccine requirements have been sent a withdrawal letter this week. We'll go to Richard calling from Sebago Lake Village. Hi, Richard. Go ahead.
Hello, Jennifer. You know, that last email kind of touches on my point, and that's that you cannot legislate morality, although some try, but you can legislate responsibility. You know, it's irresponsible to get behind the wheel of a car after you've been drinking. And if you do, you'll lose your license. I think it's equally irresponsible to potentially expose somebody to COVID. I see no reason at all not to legislate the responsibility that people have to keep other people around them healthy.
Richard, thank you. And Dimitri, how about that analogy legally, that leaving your house without a vaccine, without being vaccinated or without wearing a mask is similar to drunk driving?
Well, we've always had to do a cost-benefit analysis whenever we're, you know, limiting people's individual liberties and balancing those against societal interests and public health and well-being. And that's where, you know, courts have generally been very deferential to legislatures, right? And that's the role of Senator Timberlake and our governor and our legislator to look at the costs, look at the benefits, and try to figure out, is the harm of the vaccinations, the loss of employees, is it outweighed by the health benefits that the vaccine brings? And that's where we trust the legislatures and the executive branch to rely on the science.
Richard, thanks for your call. We'll go to Larry calling from Bangor. Hi, Larry, go ahead.
Hi, I'm over 75. When I grew up, people were getting polio and they came up with a vaccine and I never got polio, I'm thankful. We also had smallpox back when I was a boy. Nobody's getting smallpox anymore. I've lived through Legionnaires, SARS, MRSA, and now COVID. These people are children who don't want to get their vaccine. Just because Donnie told them they don't have to, they think they're being free. Being free does not entitle you to endanger someone else's health. And I'm sort of tired of their stupid and childish behavior. And I guess I'll probably get yelled at, but such is life.
Okay. Thanks, Larry, for your perspective. Let's see. We'll go to Tavis, who's calling from Reedfield. Hi, Tavis. Go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. Thanks for taking my call. And Professor Miller and Professor Bam, thank you for being wonderful educators. I still remember taking those great ethics classes at UMaine with Professor Miller and the great legal classes at Maine Law. But my question, I'm a new state representative, and as always in government, we're always trying to balance individual rights with the good of the whole. And I'm just wondering if Professor Miller could, sort of explain in philosophical terms, because I'm always curious about what the great philosophers would think, about, you know, when it's okay to limit individual rights to make their own healthcare decisions, when it will have significant impacts on the rest of society. I'm thinking, granted, it's not to this extent, but I'm thinking of the one who walked away from Omalaz in that a society that's based on restricting individual rights is always, you have to take that into consideration. But at some point in law, that's what we do. We restrict rights to make benefits for everybody else. And if you could just speak on that a little bit, that would be super helpful.
We'll start with you, Professor Miller.
Wow, that is a tall order. It is so nice to hear from you, Tavis. Yeah, so, you know, we talk about human rights and we say that they are universal. We get them just in virtue of being human. They're not granted to us by the government, and they're inalienable, which means that they can't be taken away. Someone could fail to honor them in us, but they can't take them away from us. We get them just in virtue of being human. And we take them really seriously. And liberty is very important in the United States. And this is why we do need to take seriously concerns about infringing on liberty. And we don't do it easily, or we shouldn't. But, you know, we have things like property rights. You know, I'm not just allowed to walk through somebody's lawn or squat on their property, because on balance for everyone, it's we can respect people's rights the best by limiting the way that we interact with one another. And so I actually think that vaccine mandates further civil liberties. In the end, they protect the most vulnerable among us, including people with disabilities and people with fragile immune systems. They protect our children who are too young to be vaccinated. They protect communities of color hit hard by the disease. It's not something we've covered, but we know that, indigenous populations, we know that Black and Hispanics are twice as likely to die of COVID than whites. So when we think about protecting everyone and protecting our civil liberties, we need to be thinking about putting a few limitations that, you know, we need to restrict it, right? We need to do as little as possible to get the result we want. We can't sort of willy-nilly be taking away, you know, infringing on people's rights. But I really don't believe in the argument of bodily integrity or personal liberty or freedom when it comes to these vaccines, just because we limit freedoms all the time in the name of preventing harm to others and in the name of respecting other people's rights.
Dimitri Baum, anything you'd like to add to that?
Well, I think Jessica makes a great point about balancing rights on both sides. In fact, some scholars have been suggesting that vaccine passports, for example, are required to protect people's right to travel from state to state, which is one of the constitutional rights. And the other point that I'd expand on that Jessica made as well is none of our rights are absolute. Even the ones that are phrased in absolute terms in the Constitution, they're all subject to a balancing test. We're always weighing the government interest, the strength of the government interest. And one of the most important, most compelling government interests has been public health throughout the history of this nation. So we're always balancing that right to bodily integrity, which I think is implicated here, with the public interest in health, safety, and well-being.
All right. And, you know, I'm wondering, Jessica and Tavis, thank you so much for your call and good luck as a new representative. Jessica, I'm wondering if part of this is on some sort of like basic evolutionary level, the fact that it's a needle, piercing your skin, that sort of makes this harder to discuss than many other medical ethics issues.
You know, I appreciate that point, Jennifer. I do think that there is something about a needle piercing skin. It's very symbolic in our community, in our heritage. I think I can see where, you know, it raises certain issues for people. But, you know, we're all subject to a lot of cognitive biases as well. And I think perception of risk has really skewed a lot of people's attitudes towards the vaccine, where they've sort of way overestimated the risk of the vaccine and underestimated the risk of COVID. And I don't just mean the risk of acquiring COVID or dying from COVID, but when we don't control this pandemic, we may have to do more things like bring kids home from school, for example. And when we look at the impact on our school children of remote learning, I mean, everyone is doing their best and teachers are heroes in this as well, but it's not the same. And so, you know, we have to really look at all of the factors that not controlling the pandemic can, how they can impact our entire society. But I do think that the symbolic, everything isn't rational. I'm a philosopher. I like to think of everything as rational arguments and, you know, being coherent in your beliefs across, you know, things. But I do think that there is a bodily kind of metaphorical kind of visceral reaction that some people have.
Visceral, that's the word I was looking for. Bruce is calling from Bangor. Hi, Bruce, go ahead.
Hi, Jennifer. I appreciate the sophisticated discussion of bioethics by both of your guests. As a physician, I do want to make a statement about the exposure of healthcare, of people who work in the healthcare system who apparently do not believe in science, even though they work in a industry which requires a belief in science. And I think that that it's time that that healthcare is winnowed of people who are misplaced in this profession and should go elsewhere.
Bruce, thank you for that. And Jessica, I'm going to return to you. We just have a few seconds left. Thoughts about what Bruce just said?
You know, I'm just going to push back a little bit, even though I completely, you know, agree with the frustration and I can see how, particularly for a physician, this is really challenging, a very challenging time. I think that we have to recognize that the messaging around a lot of aspects of the pandemic has felt to people inconsistent and hard to follow. I also think that we live in a world where people can be very siloed in the types of information that they receive. You know, I don't want to sound like I'm making excuses. A lot of the good information is out there if you just look. But I do think that sometimes when we look at our informational literacy, our health communication, that creates the problem.
Well, thank you all so much for being with us today. Dimitri Baum with the University of Maine School of Law and Jessica Miller with the University of Maine, a professor of philosophy, healthcare ethics consultant, and more. Today's sound engineer, George Thomas, Jonathan Smith, and Cindy Hahn produce Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Public Radio.